What happens to a society when rape becomes a weapon of war? When sexual violence is not the result of a loss of control, but strategically planned, militarily tolerated, politically ignored? In this podcast from In Crisis Mode, I speak with women in Ukraine who had to witness and endure this. It is a particularly horrific side of this war, which is already terrible enough. The stories you will hear, as always in this podcast, are not easy or comfortable to bear. Still, a trigger warning and a note that the show notes include information for people who have experienced violence outside of war or need help.
Короче, я була в такому состоянии, шокала, що далі делать, що буде.
One time I was in such a state, shocked, that I had no idea what I should do, what would happen to me. I just didn't understand it. Even though deep down, I already knew what could happen. And that's exactly what did happen. I was beaten, raped. Only the next day did some officer appear who was surprised that I was even there. Someone started explaining something to him. I was sitting in the corner on the floor, curled up, my arms wrapped around myself. I was afraid that someone might come near me. Can I smoke here?
Боялась, що хто така мені подійде. Можна я виду покурю?
Так.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of In Crisis Mode. My name is Jan Jessen. I'm the head of politics at NRZ and work as a war and crisis reporter for the Funke Media Group. You can read my reports, among others, in the WAZ, the NRZ, the Berliner Morgenpost, the Hamburger Abendblatt, or online on our platforms. Today's episode is about another brutal chapter in this war of aggression waged by Russia against Ukraine, which began in February 2022 and has escalated further in the days just before this podcast was recorded. You've probably seen it. In recent days and weeks, Russian forces have been bombing Ukraine with particularly intense force. The peace negotiations that Trump, the American president, wanted to initiate and did initiate have quite obviously come to nothing. Putin seems in these days to be putting all his cards on the table, trying to force Ukraine to its knees, to make it surrender unconditionally. There are many debates on the international stage about how Ukraine can be helped, but these particular days are especially difficult. A few weeks ago, I was traveling through Ukraine, of course, also directly at the front, where the military situation is currently developing very negatively for Ukraine, to be honest. Russian forces are currently pushing forward very strongly, especially in the Donetsk region, specifically around the city of Pokrovsk. As I said, it's a relatively difficult military situation right now. Plus, there's what I already mentioned, these massive ongoing bombardments. During my trip, I also spoke with women whose stories stand for many others, Maria and Irina. Two names, two fates, and a system that deliberately seeks to break the dignity of women. I was, among other places, in Kherson, a city in southern Ukraine we've already talked about several times in this podcast. We'll link to the relevant episodes in the show notes. Kherson is a city that was occupied by Russian troops, the only regional capital the Russians managed to bring under their control after the start of the invasion in February 2022, but which was then liberated by Ukrainian forces in autumn 2022. The problem in Kherson is the city lies within range of Russian artillery. It is shelled daily, also attacked by drones. And yes, life there is extremely dangerous and problematic. That's where I met Maria, in a small back room of a cafe. It was a somewhat surreal encounter, of course. Outside, the sound of artillery fire. Inside, cheerful music. Slightly bizarre, you have to say, especially in light of what Maria told me. She is 49 years old, used to work as a lawyer, and became the victim of a war crime, one that, in my view, is far too rarely documented. Maria comes from a small town near Kherson. I shouldn't name that town, nor should I mention Maria's real name. The reason is that her parents and her brother still live in that town, which is under Russian occupation. She's afraid that if her full name or the name of the town is mentioned, harm could come to them. In that town, she worked as a lawyer before the war. When the town was occupied, right after the start of the Russian invasion, the occupiers tried to pressure her into working for them, into collaborating. She refused. Like in many cases under Russian occupation, she was arrested, subjected to heavy interrogation, and abused. She was kept in a cell for a long time, crammed in with other women, and later taken to a farm. There was, as she told me, another young man, Andriy, who had been arrested along with her and was also taken out of town. She had been informed by the Russian occupiers that she had to leave the occupied territory because she was considered useless and because she resisted. Therefore, she was to be returned to Ukrainian-controlled territory. When they were both transported out of the town in an armored vehicle and driven toward the front, she overheard a radio message. The driver said, "I've got two people here." And the voice on the other end asked, "What kind of people?" And the driver replied, "One's a young man. You can use him for trench digging and fortifications, and with the girl, you can do whatever you want." And that's when she realized this was heading in a very dark direction. She arrived at the farm and was taken outside. And then the horror began. She was raped by several soldiers stationed there. And she also explained to me exactly who these men were.
Well, there were also people from the Caucasus there, as the major who basically saved me explained. He said it was the 6th Company, a tough unit, mainly used to throw people onto the front lines. There were both contract soldiers and convicts. There was everything. People of Caucasian origin, some with narrow eyes, maybe Bashkirs or Buryats. I don't know exactly who they all were, and also some with Slavic appearance.
Bashkirs, that's a Turkic people from Russia. The Buryats, they come from Siberia, and they are also an ethnic minority. And especially at the beginning of the war, it was the case that members of minorities were deployed by the Russian armed forces. In the beginning, they avoided sending people from, for example, Moscow or St. Petersburg. Petersburg, because they believed, bluntly put, that it was better to sacrifice those who wouldn't rebel much. So it was mainly members of minorities who were deployed in the first years of the war, and Maria tried to remember her tormentors. That was, of course, difficult, and especially in such a conversation. You're sitting across from a woman who has experienced horrors at the hands of men who did terrible things to her. You're a man sitting in front of her, and that's obviously a difficult situation. And I didn't want to push too hard, of course, because it was clear that just remembering what had happened to her was already really distressing for her. At times, she had tears in her eyes, she kept taking deep breaths, and eventually she said, "I have to stand up and go smoke a cigarette now." It was truly very burdensome for her, and possibly re-traumatizing. And generally speaking, when we as journalists speak with victims of violence or crimes, it's always like walking a tightrope. It's always difficult. On one hand, of course, you want to hear the person's story. On the other hand, you don't want to pressure them into a place where they feel completely unwell. And with this conversation, that was especially intense. So I didn't push too much, didn't urge her to go into too much detail. I think that would have been completely inappropriate. In any case, and I found this particularly striking, Maria was rescued by a Russian officer. She experienced this mass rape, this horror in the night, and then, as she said at the beginning, she was crouched in the corner trying to cover herself somehow, and then this officer came in, and he asked, what's going on with her? What is happening here? And then he ordered his men to stop immediately. I don't think that was necessarily out of compassion, but rather because they had gone completely over the line, and he made sure that she got out of that situation. And I found that, as I said, a remarkable aspect, that she shared this, that even though Russian soldiers inflicted this horror on her, it was a Russian officer who got her out. And by the way, that's something I've heard from other war zones as well. I remember the Balkan Wars. It happened there too that especially militias or militiamen abused women. And again, officers stepped in, people embedded in military structures, and said, "Stop it, not like this." And generally, one has to say this bitter truth. Rape and mass rape are part of war. As brutal as that sounds, rape is used again and again as a weapon of war. That's not just the case in this war in Ukraine, it's the case in every war zone around the world, and I've seen it myself and reported many stories about it. In Iraq, for example, when the so-called Islamic State established its terror caliphate, more than 6,000 Yazidi women and children were abducted. The women were used as sex slaves in a very brutal way. To this day, around 2,000 Yazidi women remain missing. That too was a deliberate effort to break the Yazidi people, to destroy their dignity, to shatter that community. And it seems that something similar might be happening in Ukraine. In any case, Maria also told me how she got out of that situation.
And when he, the major, found out what had happened, he said, "Yes, indeed, you're in their database. You won't get through anywhere anymore. The only way is to get out over the bridge that leads further on, there by Minskoye, then into the Zaporizhia region and on to Zaporizhia itself. Only that way, through the front line. But you'll hardly make it." I said, "I'll take the risk. Maybe I'll make it." But he said, "Calm down. No one will touch you here anymore. I've given the order that you are to be left alone." That somehow calmed me down.
The database she spoke about, that's a database of the Russian Secret Service. They interrogated her, and as mentioned, she ended up in this database as someone who was, so to speak, undesirable in the occupied territories, obviously. And it was her luck that her name was found there, because otherwise this major might not have helped her. And yes, that's how she got out of that area. She told me about it in great detail, walking dozens of kilometers on foot. And to this day, she doesn't know how she really made it out, but she survived. She made it out. Of course, she is still deeply wounded in her soul, but she survived this horror nonetheless. That, of course, was not the case for all women. Olha Cherniak, that was another woman I met there. We're not playing you any original audio from her now, but she also told me about another aspect of these abuses, and it's something I've heard again and again from people, especially from Kherson. After the liberation of this city, I went there multiple times and spoke with people who had lived through the occupation, and they also told me how brutal the occupation regime was, that everyone who was even suspected of still working for the Ukrainian side was interrogated under extremely harsh conditions. And Olha Cherniak told me that they used her son to force her into making confessions. She actually worked for the employment agency in Kherson, wasn't political at all or otherwise active, but she was suspected, allegedly because a neighbor had betrayed her, saying she was spying for Ukraine. And then they brutally abused her son. They beat him. They attached electrodes to his genitals and electrocuted him. Eventually, he was screaming and whimpering, and she had to listen to all of it. And at some point, she gave a confession, a false one, of course, because she says, "I didn't do anything." She then endured a long, long period of suffering, 280 days in Russian captivity, also under horrific conditions. She said she had to go to the toilet in front of the guards, she had to shower in front of them, when that was even allowed, which only happened every few weeks. There were no hygiene products for the women, so in essence there may not have been rape, but definitely sexual abuse in what happened to Olha. Olha now works for the self-help organization SEMA. That stands for Survivors of Sexual Violence from Eastern Ukraine. And that's an organization by survivors, for survivors. It was founded by Irina Dovgan. She herself was once a prisoner and experienced that horror firsthand. However, this was before the beginning of the Russian invasion in February 2022. She experienced it earlier, when the war in the Donbas began in 2014. This war, as all Ukrainians say, didn't just start in 2022. It began back in 2014, during the so-called Euromaidan. You might remember back then the pro-Russian president Yanukovych was overthrown by people protesting against him in Kyiv. Then in eastern Ukraine, a separatist movement arose calling this a coup, heavily supported by Russia, and through military conflict, took control of Donetsk and Luhansk, two major cities, which remain occupied to this day. And it was during that time that Irina experienced what she had to endure, and she founded this organization because she felt abandoned by the Ukrainian state.
Since
2014, these women have been abandoned by the state, with their trauma, with their psychological problems.
Sexual violence, abuse, rape, these are, of course, still taboo topics in virtually every war to this day. Women who have experienced such things often feel ashamed to go public with it, are afraid of being re-traumatized. Sometimes there simply aren't any support centers or contact points for them. And I've seen this on other battlefields as well. As I said, I mentioned the example of Iraq, where those mass rapes of Yazidi women took place. There too, it was extremely difficult for the women to return to their communities. It is very difficult to bring this topic into communities, to even get a conversation going about it. So it's still very, very difficult. And as I said, this applies not just to Ukraine, not just to Iraq, but also to other war zones. And in that regard, it's of course a great thing when women come together on their own support each other and create a space to talk about such experiences. And that's exactly what SEMA is for. SEMA supports survivors, helps with therapy, with money, and with appropriate structures. And Irina says, yes, of course, support eases the pain, but it doesn't heal it.
But I want to make it clear once again. For them, it's simply part of everyday life. Nothing more and nothing less.
Russia, Irina claims, and other Ukrainian sources claim it too, as do the United Nations, systematically uses sexualized violence as a weapon, as a means of control, and as an instrument for destroying Ukrainian identity. That is also a recurring pattern that we've seen in other conflicts as well, that it is, of course, also about humiliation. And you might remember when Hamas launched that unprecedented attack on Israel in October 2023, there were also horrific scenes of rape at the Nova Festival, that techno festival where young people were just celebrating and simply having fun. And then Hamas commandos, along with accompanying or allied militias, stormed in, and they didn't just murder and abduct people, but also raped many, many women. Even that, before it was clarified and before it became public, took a very, very long time. Just now, in the days leading up to the recording of this episode, it has once again become a topic. But even there, it took a very long time before these crimes could be addressed and before testimonies emerged. And that's always a core part of the pattern. Maria survived, but she didn't just want to escape. She wanted to leave something behind. A trace, a hope, a coordinate that shows, I saw who it was, and maybe somewhere there will be justice. And she expressed that very starkly. And yes, I can understand it from her perspective.
I don't know. I can hardly believe it. But I hope so. I hope that the 6th company was bombed after I had shown where they were located.
Of course, that's part of the truth as well. You can't verify such stories in detail, but there are very, very many testimonials, witnesses, and statements from Ukrainian women who report or have reported what happened to them. But you can also see it in the number of cases that have now been opened by the Ukrainian Prosecutor General's Office for the crime of sexualized violence in the context of war, that by no means all cases have yet come to light. So far, only about 340 cases have been opened by the Ukrainian Prosecutor General's Office. They only proceed when they have appropriate witness statements, when the women were willing to open up and speak about what happened to them. And on the one hand, there are obviously still many women who are hesitant to do that, perhaps because they're afraid or out of shame or for whatever other reasons. It's estimated that the number of unreported cases in the territories that were liberated in autumn 2022 is around 20 times higher than the cases that have actually become known so far. And on top of that, we don't know what has happened in the areas currently occupied by Russia in recent years. We don't know what's been going on in Donetsk and Luhansk since 2014. We don't know what's happened in the regions of Zaporizhzhia and Kherson, which are still occupied by Russian forces. So there is simply a huge grey area or black box where we just don't know what has occurred. As mentioned, the United Nations has repeatedly and clearly condemned and criticized this, that Russia is committing war crimes and using sexualized violence as a weapon of war. And therefore, what Maria said, what Irina said, or what Olga shared is certainly credible. And generally speaking, I believe we should first of all believe the victims. And if they tell such stories, why would anyone make something like that up? It's absurd. As I said, what Maria experienced stands as an example for many cases. And this is not collateral damage of war. It is systematic. It is a strategy to break down societies. And it is also the case that not only women are victims of sexualized violence in this war. Earlier I mentioned Olga's son and how he was abused. That also happens to men. There have also been rapes of men, of Ukrainian prisoners of war. That too has been reported again and again, that it is being used as a weapon, as a psychological weapon to force confessions, or simply to break people, to humiliate people, to punish people. And Irina states again very clearly why this weapon is being used in this way.
Обговорено те, що
сексуальне насильство для Росії є зброя війни.
Recently, there has been intense discussion, not only within our organization, but also among all human rights groups, that sexual violence is being used as a weapon of war by Russia. And I have very often heard the same sentence from survivors, especially from men in this new organization that was only recently founded, that sexual violence against men in Kherson was the fastest and cheapest way for FSB officers to force the confessions they wanted. When electric shock devices were attached to the victim's genitals, or, excuse me, when the anus was penetrated with broomsticks or similar objects, people very quickly signed anything that was demanded of them.
Крокодильчики і пускався ток, або, вибачте, в задній отвір засовувався черенок від швабри, то людина дуже швидко підписувала все, що тим ФСБшникам було потрібно.
What's also important, I think, is that for those who have experienced such things, they are, of course, deeply traumatized. Whether they are men, women, or children, they may now be living in safety, in so-called safety, but they are living with their trauma. And I said so-called safety because the front is constantly moving closer to them. As I mentioned earlier, in Kherson, for example, there is artillery fire every day. Drones are flying in every single day, and the front is gradually creeping forward. And for those who are already traumatized and have to live with their trauma and somehow cope with it, this is, of course, an additional burden.
Most women say, we live near the front line. We do live in the deoccupied, the liberated areas. But the war is not over yet. The front line is only 15 kilometers from my home.
SEMA, the self-help organization that Irina founded at the time, now helps over 1,000 survivors. It is one of several aid or self-help organizations in Ukraine, but certainly one of the most outspoken. Irina has also spoken before various committees, including the United Nations and the European Parliament. And what Irina says is very, very clear. It may come across as a bit shocking, but I think it's completely understandable from her perspective.
Мене змушує вважати, що вони не люди, що вони використовують...
It makes me believe that they are not human, that, like wild animals, they use sexualized violence as a means to break the Ukrainian people. I have very often heard that they do it simply out of spite, out of envy. They constantly felt envy toward the Ukrainians they occupied.
Вони постійно відчували заздрість до тих українців, яких вони окупували.
Yes, the war in Ukraine is far from over. Especially in the past few days, it has become clear that the war machinery is operating at an increasingly high pace. As I mentioned, there have been mass bombardments of Ukrainian cities in recent days, particularly the capital, Kyiv, is in the spotlight. At the front, Russian troops continue to advance. A ceasefire or even a peace agreement is currently neither visible nor conceivable. Putin is not budging an inch, holding fast to his minimum military demands, namely the surrender without a fight of cities like Kramatorsk, Slovyansk, Pokrovsk, or also Zaporizhzhia and Kherson. That cannot and will not happen, of course. And now the question is, how will things continue? Ukraine needs help and urgently needs support, especially in terms of air defense systems, to protect its population and infrastructure. In the long term, Ukraine will, of course, also need help with reconstruction, but what Ukraine also needs is simply support for the people who have become victims in this war, and in particular, of course, the women and men who have been victims of sexualized violence. I believe that's a kind of emotional connection that goes far beyond what many soldiers had to endure or what civilians experienced during bombardments. Sexualized violence, I believe, inflicts even deeper and more severe wounds than what others may have experienced. And that makes it all the more important that everything these people have endured is, on the one hand, investigated and processed, and on the other hand, that they receive support. But above all, that if at all possible the perpetrators are held accountable, that they are brought to justice, that they are prosecuted, and that they receive the appropriate punishment for the crimes they committed. Anyone who downplays this and says, well, that's just part of war, unfortunately, a regrettable aspect of warfare is protecting the perpetrators. And that simply must not happen. It must not happen in Ukraine, it must not happen in Sudan, it must not happen in Israel, it must not happen in Iraq, it must not happen anywhere in the world. Sexualized violence is a crime, and must be prosecuted accordingly. You can find all episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and of course on the platforms of the Funke Media Group. If you have questions, feedback, or would like to share any information, feel free to email. New episodes are released every 2 weeks. Occasionally, we also produce special episodes in response to current events. Those are, of course, also available on the platforms. Thank you for listening today, even though this was certainly a difficult and heavy episode. Thank you for being with us. Stay alert. Take care of yourselves. All the best. See you soon.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Podcast von Funke.